Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, September 9th, and I'm Nat Cardos, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, fire updates on the Dillon, Blue, and Log fires, Defend Democracy Fair comes to Eureka September 14th, Remembering Robert Wood Sutherland, wildlife officers determine Eureka bear death as not poaching, and September 10th, Eureka Road Construction will close eastbound Boone Street temporarily. So stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
Updates on the Dillon Fire, Blue Fire, and Log Fire. The Dillon Fire is currently at 11,971 acres and is 59% contained. There are currently 1,152 personnel on scene. Precipitation started Monday afternoon and reduced some fire activity, though the fire area will continue to smolder, leaving smoke to linger in nearby valleys. KMUD News spoke with Linda Babcock, Public Information Officer trainee for the Dillon Fire, for more information.
So the firefighters are going to go direct today ahead of some incoming weather. So they're going to be strengthening the lines along Rock Creek again. They secured the fire up through Forest Road 13 and 24, and that's with a combination of hand lines and cold trailing. It's a method of controlling a partly dead fire edge by carefully inspecting and feeling it with your hand to detect if there's any fire. Then you dig out the live spots, and then you trench any live edges. One other thing I want to mention about the Dillon Fire, we did get an inch of rain on that fire yesterday. So if there's like a big stump or a log, maybe a big tree on fire, then that will continue to smolder. But the smaller material, it will most of the time put it out. It'll smolder and smoke.
Intermittent closures of Highway 96 are possible. Road updates can be found on the Caltrans website at dot.ca.gov/travel. And now an update on the Blue Fire. The Blue Fire is currently at 3,543 acres and is 18% contained. There are currently 778 personnel on scene. Firefighters expect additional containment on the fire today, and while precipitation may dampen the fire, there will likely be opportunities for it to grow due to warmer weather expected later in the week. KMUD News spoke with Ryan Berlin, Fire Information Officer for California Team 1, for the Blue and Log fires, for more information.
Yesterday has diminished with substantial amount of rain that's come in yesterday, late yesterday, and all last night. So fire activity right now is kind of just smoldering in place. That's what we anticipated to do over the next couple of days. Rain is forecasted for this evening and little showers tomorrow. So while this happens with the moisture, it gives the firefighters a heads up and a little bit of an advantage to put containment line around where we can reach safely.
A virtual community meeting for the Blue and Dillon fires will take place tomorrow, Wednesday, September 10th, at 6 p.m. and will be live-streamed on the Klamath National Forest Facebook page. There are currently evacuation orders and warnings in place for the Blue and Dillon fires. To find evacuation information, the website is protect.genesis.com. That's protect.genasys.com. The Pacific Crest Trail is still closed between the junction with Kelsey National Recreation Trail and Sayad Valley. Shelter information and evacuation resources are available through the Siskiyou County Office of Emergency Services at 530-340-3539. And now an update on the log fire. The log fire is currently 1,168 acres and 0% contained, with 44 personnel on scene. Efforts are still being made to protect historic cabins in the area. Berlin explains more about fire operations at the log fire.
And that fire, it's in the wilderness, so it hasn't been moving a lot because it's in very rugged terrain. It's only been adding a few acres per day. It also received some moisture last night and anticipated more moisture today. The crews and firefighter personnel that are assigned to it are in the wildfire use modules, and they're kind of a specialty crew that go in, and there's some historic cabins up there that they are wrapping with fire retardant, it's tinfoil essentially, so it helps, you know, reflect the conductive heat and the radiant heat, so it's very helpful to suppress the fire. So, and they have some other crews that are cutting a trail up there. The only access into this fire is by foot or pack mules. and it hasn't been cleared for several years. So that's what some of the fire personnel, too, are trying to clear away. So if we do have to go up into that area, we'll have a little better access.
There are currently no evacuation warnings or orders in place for the log fire. KMUN News will continue to bring updates on fires during this 2025 fire season. On September 14th, Humboldt Democracy Connections will be hosting the Defend Democracy Fair at Madigat Square in Eureka from noon to 4 p.m. There will be food vendors, face painting, and tabling with pro-democracy organizations like Humboldt for Palestine and Students for a Democratic Society. This free event will also have a Defend Democracy costume contest. KMUN News spoke with Marley Nelson, one of the team leads for protest planning for the Humboldt Democracy Connections team, for more information about the event.
We are super jazzed about it. It's going to be a big community event. The focus is, of course, democracy. We'll have at least a dozen other pro-democracy orgs tabling. Eureka Books will be there selling pro-democracy books. There will be food. There will be face painting. There will be music, a costume contest. It's really going to be a whole blast. We have given ourselves a month and a half to plan this, which is quite an endeavor considering the size of it. But there's a team of 8 of us, and we split up roles between coordinating with musicians and reaching out to volunteers and reaching out to other orgs. It's really a big team effort, and it's required a lot of meetings and communication, and I'm really proud of how far we've gotten with it.
This is the first time that Humboldt Democracy Connections has put on a fair of this kind, and it comes during a time of general political unrest. Nelson elaborates why community building and education are important in times like these.
Fighting fascism and standing up for democracy is, you know, I would say obviously the most important thing we can do right now. It's going to be paramount to crawling out of what we're suffering through, frankly. But joy is an act of resistance, and we want to build that joy and that community. And we all need each other in this fight. And it's really cool to see folks who didn't know each other, orgs that have never worked together, coming together for a day of joy and really just leaning into that, nourishing our hearts and bringing some more energy into this activism space.
Local representatives will also be present at this event to answer questions, and there will also be a bake sale benefiting Centro del Pueblo. It is also a zero-waste event, and attendees are encouraged to bring their own utensils. For more information, the website is humdem.org. If you have any questions, you can also email info@humdem.org. On August 21st, Robert Sutherland, widely known in Southern Humboldt as the man who walks in the woods, or simply as Woods, passed away at 82. Sutherland first arrived in Humboldt County in 1968 and became a full-time resident, where he immersed himself in environmental and community activism. In 1977, he co-founded the Environmental Protection Information Center, EPIC, in Garberville, and was the driving force behind dozens of lawsuits against Pacific Lumber, fighting for old-growth redwoods. KMUN News spoke with Tom Wheeler, current executive director of EPIC, to talk more about the legacy Sutherland leaves behind with his work.
Robert, man who walks in the woods, Sutherland, like so many people in SoHum, came up from San Francisco, you know, after the Summer of Love, was burnt out on San Francisco and the scene there, and wanted to kind of live out his countercultural values. And so came up here in the early 1970s and set up home in Southern Humboldt and began to take long walks through the woods of the Sinkione Coast. And this is kind of reflected in his name. He adopted the name Man Who Walks in the Woods, which we often just shorten to Woods. And this was a reflection of one of his favorite pastimes, and also a nod to his countercultural beliefs and his kind of radicalism. And that radicalism expressed itself in environmental conservation. He was a firm defender of the woods in which he worked and walked. So he was concerned about industrial timber and its effects on the North Coast. He saw what Georgia Pacific was doing to old growth forests in Southern Humboldt and Northern Mendocino counties, and created EPIC for the purposes, among other things, of taking on industrial timber production. So first it was fighting against aerial herbicide application, where they were applying an herbicide that was very similar to Agent Orange, which legions of Vietnam vets came back having been exposed to overseas. And then with this group together, he and others in the community started to fight against timber harvest plans that proposed logging old growth. And Woods was an indelible spirit. He was extremely smart, and he was not an attorney, but he taught himself the law in order to start fighting better for the forest. So he came up with a lot of EPIC's early legal strategies, which won us huge victories in court. And he was involved with EPIC for a good number of years, and then turned his passions to supporting mom-and-pop cannabis operations in southern Humboldt, working with HumMap to ensure that, this kind of countercultural spirit of cannabis production in southern Humboldt was able to continue. So we're all reeling from the loss and doing our best to remember all that he has left us.
From stopping harmful logging operations to influencing conversation around cannabis, Sutherland leaves behind a legacy of unwavering conviction and dedication to the woods he's walked. At 7 p.m. this evening, the Environment Show with Duff on KMUD will be dedicating the first half of the show to Sutherland's remembrance. For more information, the website is kmud.org. On September 3rd, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, CDFW, received a CalTIP report stating that two bears had been shot near Ridgewood Drive, south of Eureka. As of today, the CDFW confirmed that there was only one bear in the incident and that it was not poached, but humanely authorized by law enforcement after sustaining injuries. KMUD News spoke with Jen Benedette, Deputy Director of Communications for the CDFW, for more information on the incident.
The California Department of Fish and Wildlife has resolved public concern regarding reports of a poached bear in Eureka. Following a thorough investigation, wildlife officers determined the bear was not a victim of poaching, but was instead humanely euthanized by law enforcement after sustaining severe injuries, likely from a vehicle strike. On September 3rd, CDFW received a CalTIP report alleging two bears had been shot near Ridgewood Drive, south of Eureka. Neighbors reported hearing multiple gunshots during the overnight hours of August 30th. And suspicions circulated about potential poaching. A responding CDFW wildlife officer interviewed witnesses and canvassed the area, but found no bear carcasses or physical evidence. Further investigation revealed that in the early morning of August 31st, law enforcement partners from the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office and California Highway Patrol jointly responded to reports of an injured bear repeatedly entering the roadway on Ridgewood Drive. The animal displayed severe head trauma, walked in circles, and was unable to escape traffic. To relieve the animal's suffering and to ensure public safety, CHP officers humanely euthanized the single adult male bear at approximately 4:30 a.m. Witness reports of three gunshots matched the number of rounds fired.
Interviews with residents and officials confirmed that only one bear was involved and the carcass had been removed by Humboldt County Road Services on September 2nd. No evidence has been found that supports the claims of a second bear or illegal poaching. CalTIP, or Californians Turn In Poachers and Polluters, is a confidential program for reporting wildlife crimes, and anyone with information about potential violations is encouraged to call 888-334-2258. Tomorrow, September 10th, the City of Eureka's contractor will be doing construction work on eastbound Boone Street between S Street and Harrison Avenue. The eastbound lane on Boone Street will be closed during this time. KMUD News spoke with Brittany Powell, project manager, for what drivers can expect.
Yes, tomorrow we are going to be closing down eastbound Boone Street at S Street between S and Harrison Avenue. The city's contractor is replacing a sewer lateral, and that's requiring us to close one lane of Boone. Again, and that's between S as in Sam and Harrison Avenue. And this work will be taking place approximately 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Westbound lane will stay open. And the patience of drivers is appreciated. The nearest detour is going to be on Harris Street.
The westbound lane for Boone Street will remain open during construction, and the City of Eureka Public Works advises drivers to please drive carefully in the vicinity of this and all work zones. For questions, the contact is bpowell@eurekaca.gov. In state news, California leaders slam Supreme Court decision on ICE raids, Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
Leaders across California are speaking out against the Supreme Court's decision Monday to allow federal immigration agents to racially profile Californians suspected of being undocumented, at least for now. The High Court vacated a temporary restraining order, which means the sweeping ICE raids can continue while the case is decided. Ernest Herrera with the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund says the decision means that ICE agents can also question someone based on the language they speak or their presumed occupation.
Justice Kavanaugh sacrifices the rights of all Latinos to the false Trumpist idol of unconstrained immigration enforcement. This Trump administration are going to be allowed to do an ethnic cleansing of this country and go after the people they see as enemies, which are Latinos.
The Department of Homeland Security called the decision a win for the safety of Californians and the rule of law. ICE has conducted major raids in Southern California, targeting day laborers and farm workers. American citizens and legal residents have been violently detained by agents in civilian clothes, wearing face masks, driving unmarked cars. Chef Freitas is president of the CFT, a union of educators and classified professionals. He says this decision draws our nation further into authoritarianism. Herrera calls the indiscriminate immigration stops unconstitutional.
The most basic principles of our government under the Fourth Amendment, to be free of unreasonable search and seizure, that's being thrown out the window.
L.A. Mayor Karen Bass said this decision will lead to more working families being torn apart. Governor Gavin Newsom added, this isn't about enforcing immigration laws. It's about targeting Latinos to deliberately harm California's families and small businesses. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, labor immigrant advocates speak out on a massive immigration raid at Hyundai plant in Georgia, KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
Last week's massive immigration raid at a Hyundai manufacturing plant in Georgia swept up 475 people. Among those detained, about 300 people from South Korea, along with people from Guatemala, Colombia, Chile, Mexico, Ecuador, and Venezuela. And the results of the raid have left many people in shock. Daniela Rodriguez is director of the group Migrant Equity Southeast. She says last Thursday she woke up to devastating news.
Helicopters and drones circled the facility. Roads were blocked. And our phones rang nonstop. Calls from desperate family members looking for their loved ones. The calls have not stopped since then.
She was speaking at a news conference called by immigrant and workers' rights advocates, and they see the raid as an attack on both immigrants and workers. Sarah Park is president of the Korean American Coalition. She says the Hyundai plant where the raid took place is the largest investment in state history, holding out the promise of economic growth and international cooperation.
But the promises has now been overshadowed. On September 4th, ICE carried out the largest single-site raid in its history, a Hyundai LG plant near Savannah. Instead of partnership, the world saw 475 workers shackled and treated as criminals.
She says some of the workers had short-term visitors' visas for specialized work, but now she says they're being scapegoated for filling gaps created by society. Meredith Yun is litigation director at Asian Americans Advancing Justice.
Many of the workers ICE detained had work permits and other forms of documentation. Documented or not, no one should be subjected to militarized raids in their workplace. No family should live in fear of being torn apart. According to reports, ICE and other law enforcement agencies descended upon the worksite, heavily armed and flanked with helicopters, drones, and military vehicles, blank warrant forms in hand, showing that they were planning to detain individuals indiscriminately.
The activists are calling for accountability from Hyundai and its contractors, actions from local officials rather than silence, due process, and the release of all immigrants. And the activists are standing up for workers' rights. Activist Jenny is a labor rights organizer with Migrant Equity Southeast.
What happened at Hyundai is not just an immigration issue. It is a labor rights crisis. No worker should fear being met with militarized force at their job. No family should fear being torn apart for showing up to work. This is why we're calling for transparency, accountability, and immediate support for those impacted.
One lawmaker showed up at the event, Georgia State Representative Ann Allen Westbrook. She says the rule of law protects all of us, or it protects none of us.
I think the context matters at this time. This is ICE detention at a time when ICE is ever expanding ever resourced, while every other agency that supports Americans is less and less resourced. This is ICE detention at a time when due process is out the window.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Israeli strike demolishes high-rise in Gaza City as Israel tells Palestinians to evacuate. KPFA's Rami Elmagheri reports.
The 15-story Al-Susi residential high-rise is among five high-rises in Gaza City knocked down by Israeli aircraft since Friday. The high-rise, home to dozens of families, is now leveled to the ground. The blast, so intense, several shelter tents nearby were torn apart from the strikes. Ayman Marouf is a displaced resident from northern Gaza. His tent was one of those destroyed from the bombings today.
I was outdoor, and when I came back, I found out that my tent was torn apart. And thank God that my children turned up safe. I appeal to all Islamic nations to help solve this conflict. It is true that they ordered us to leave for the south, but this is something that we cannot afford. Every time I go to Zakim to get some food supplies, I face death multiple times.
Other impacted residents had just moved near the Al-Susi Tower after fleeing eastern Gaza City, where the Israeli military had already intensified military strikes. Ward Maruf was sitting on the ground in front of the tower's rubble after the strike. She and her family members were collecting some of their belongings when she told Pacifica they only had a 30-minute warning before the building was bombed to rubble.
We were displaced from Nefek 10 days ago. We got notice only half an hour before they knocked it down. We could hardly save our luggage. I know they want us to displace to the south, but I don't feel like it because I had a terrible experience when I was forced to flee to the south previously. I was injured, and it took 7 months to treat.
In Gaza City, shelter tents are spread in nearly every corner after months of intensive Israeli army actions in eastern and northern parts of Gaza City. Recently, the army announced it would take over the whole city and ordered its 1 million population to flee south to where the Israeli army says a safe humanitarian zone. Since last Friday, Israeli aircrafts began knocking down a list of high-rises in Gaza City, saying they have been used by Hamas for terrorist purposes. The army posted on social media a map that includes dozens of such buildings, but building owners refute those claims. Meanwhile, mediation efforts for a ceasefire continue after U.S. President Donald Trump proposed Hamas release all Israeli hostages held by Hamas in return for Israel's release of 2,000 to 3,000 Palestinian prisoners. Hamas is demanding an end to Israel's military operations across the Gaza Strip and the withdrawal of all Israeli forces. Israel insists Hamas should disarm and the party's leaders be exiled. For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I am Rami El-Mighari, in Gaza.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska's Office of Children's Services is defending its practices in a court case that began in August. A national organization brought the class action lawsuit, hoping it can force court-mandated reforms to a system they say is failing kids and violating the Indian Child Welfare Act. About two-thirds of children in out-of-home care in the state are Alaska Native. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has more.
When former foster youth Matthew Vandenberg took the stand on the first day of the federal trial, he told the judge about a foster placement he and other foster youth called the Ramen House. He recounted his testimony in an interview.
the people there would give you 2 ramen packs a day. And if you ate them, say, in the morning, you would have to wait until the next day to eat again. I lost over 30 pounds being at that foster home.
OCS is supposed to visit kids in their care monthly, but Marsha Lowry says those monthly visits in Alaska just aren't happening. She's an attorney and director of a national nonprofit, A Better Childhood, that brings lawsuits against states to push for foster care reforms.
How else can you know whether a child is safe when you put a child in a foster home?
Lowry says that on many federal measures, Alaska's foster care system ranks among the worst in the country.
Alaska is one of the few places that I know of that hires workers who don't have college degrees.
Lowry says lawsuits like this can be an effective way to force system reforms. She says when they sued New Jersey in 1999, their system was one of the worst in the country. Now it's one of the best. Alaska's foster care system has long been plagued with serious problems. In 2018, a law required reforms meant to reduce caseloads and staff turnover. The final audit released this year showed that by most measures, OCS hasn't made meaningful progress. The Office of Children's Services declined an interview for this story, but in her testimony, OCS Director Kim Gway consistently pointed out that her office is just one piece of Alaska's child welfare system. The federal trial is slated to wrap up September 10th. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Recently, we brought you a story about a New Zealand man who was reunited with his Indigenous family in Canada after 50 years. He was part of Canada's 60 Scoop, and as Dan Karpinchuk reports, others who were taken away want help finding their biological relatives.
Jonathan Hooker of New Zealand recently returned to Manitoba and met his biological mother and other family members. He had been searching for them for years. He had been taken from them when he was only a few months old. Catherine Strongwind had a similar story. Only a year old when she was removed from her family in Winnipeg in 1973, she lived with a non-Indigenous family in Winnipeg. After years of searching, she eventually found her biological siblings and extended family. Strongwind and Hooker are among the estimated 20,000 Indigenous children who were taken from their families between the 1950s and 1980s. Many of those children were placed in non-Indigenous homes across Canada and around the globe. It was a plan of forced assimilation of Native children into white culture. University of Winnipeg history professor Karen Froman says most of the children didn't know about their Indigenous roots.
A lot of these adoptees are learning about their true heritage later in life, and a lot of them were lied to. You know, they were told they were either, you know, French or Italian, right, to explain why they were a little bit brown.
Froman says the 60s scoop was part government policy and part misunderstanding. She says rather than address social problems, it was easier for governments to remove the children. Advocates say as many as 3,000 Indigenous children were sent out of Canada and around the world. They say there must be more support so every one of those children can return home and meet with their families and communities. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, Remy Almagari, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Are you passionate about your community? Looking to report on what's happening around Mendocino? KMUD News is looking for stringer reporters from the Mendocino area to cover local Mendocino stories that matter. Whether you're a seasoned journalist or just eager to learn, we'll help you get started. You'll get training, support, and a chance to amplify real voices from your community. If you're interested, email news@kmud.org for more information. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.